One of the things bringing us and many others to India at the moment is the sense that it's on the cusp of major new prosperity and influence. It is, after all, regularly described as the world's second fastest growing economy. And the question we were preoccupied by was, how does that feel to Indians on the ground? Modern India's international image is certainly up big time. The great Indian diaspora is, of course, an immensely influential group. Five of the world's top CEOs are now Indian. The first non-European head of the influential Harvard Business School in its almost 120-year history is an Indian. We were keen to see for ourselves the source of some of this entrepreneurialism and how this group saw India's future. And in one area especially, telecommunications, there's explosive growth underway. There are 400 television stations on air right now and an additional 150 planned. And as Australians discovered last year during the Indian students drama, this makes for a super heightened media marketplace. So we drove out about 45 minutes from Delhi to a new suburb or city really called Noida, with its own slum already, I might add, which houses Delhi's media industry in order to meet one of the real stars, Raghav Bal. He's the founder, controlling shareholder and managing director of Network 18. He founded the TV18 group in 1993, and he's built it into a powerful force through joint ventures with some of the global giants like Time Warner and NBC and Viacom. He's one of India's most admired entrepreneurs, and it was a pleasure to welcome Mr. Bal to Saturday Extra.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Now, Australians, I think, did really get a massive shock. I don't think I'm overstating it, when they saw the nature of coverage, some of which they thought was absurdly biased and shrill over the Indian students. And I think that's died down a bit now. But did you understand what was happening when you saw all that underway? Like, help Australians put some context on what occurred during that time.
Well, I think, two or three things need to be understood if you want to put a context around what happened and how it happened. One is that India's television media or the whole television news networks are very young. They are not more than about 8 or 9 years old, if that. They are driven by a lot of very, very young kids. I would say people in their 20s who have not come through mainstream journalism. At least the bulk of them haven't. Some of the leaders certainly have, but the bulk of them have come straight from college and have gotten into journalism. That's one part to understand. So therefore, the kind of language, the kind of adjectives, the kind of shrillness, the word that you used, comes a bit from the exuberance and inexperience of youth. So I would put both those things together. Then the other thing is that there were a lot of news reports about hate crimes. India reacts quite passionately, negatively to all stories which, you know, go back to any element of prejudice or racism, any element. Because I think as a country, we've come through 300 years of foreign colonial British domination, something that was there just 60 years ago, 65 years ago. So it's not been very long. And there is a whole couple of generations here who carry very vivid memories of having lived through or having seen their parents live through racial discrimination of a very high order. So I think that's something that Indians react to. When you put these three facts together, that there were hate crimes, they may have been pure crimes and not racial in any way because, you know, they happened in a land very far away. You put that with the exuberance and inexperience and the sheer ebullience of India's 8-year-old, 9-year-old television networks. And then you layer it over with the fact that Indians for several generations have lived with this racial prejudice to which they now react still with a lot of passion. I think when you put these two or three things together, you would begin to at least understand somehow and somewhat of the kind of shrillness and, the decibel at which this was pitched.
Do you think there was lasting damage done to Australia's reputation?
You know, I don't think so. I think Indians can be a passionate people, can be a very emotional people, and a lot of reactions happen in the heat of the moment and in the passion of the moment. But I don't think Indians are also people who carry their prejudices for too long. And I think once they saw that there was genuine effort made by the Prime Minister of Australia, he came, and the Immigration Minister, and then the ambassador here, they reached out to the media. I think there was a lot of explaining. And then there was follow-up action. And then somehow the number of crimes also came down. I think a lot of it has died down. And the other thing is that there are a lot of Indians who are now there in Australia or who've got their children in Australia. So I think there was some sensible commentary which emerged from there also that, listen, this is not all about Australia. This is about one particular city and one particular few suburbs which probably have a tendency towards a higher crime rate where most of these incidents were happening.
So I just wonder for yourself, I mean, obviously you're already very successful, but you know, we have our own Rupert Murdoch, who's a multimedia mogul. Is that what you're setting yourself up to be, if I don't, you may even think of yourself, what comes next is really what I'm asking for you.
Well, you know, we compete with Mr. Murdoch and his companies here. You know, he's an icon of the media world. What he's done is phenomenal all across the world. We just compete with him in this very small operation of his in India, which is a small part of his empire. But yes, we do compete with him. So I think, as far as we are concerned, we are building out a full fully diversified media company. We are very large news broadcasters, very large entertainment broadcasters. We are into some verticals like children's and youth entertainment. We are trying to get our way into the regional markets of India, but we are also equally focused in the digital side, in the e-commerce side, into the transactions side on the internet.
Well, I do notice some extraordinary figures. 7% of Indians are on the net. 32% of Chinese are, 77% of Americans. That's a staggering set of numbers, isn't it?
Yes, in a sense, it also shows you how India is actually lagging in the internet. You know, just to give you one more staggering number there. In China, you have about 900 million cell phone users, or thereabouts. And you've got about nearly 500 million broadband users. In India, we've got now nearly 800 million cell phone users. But guess what is the number of our broadband users? About 7 million. So it's a joke. And the reason for that is that we've had a very poor broadband infrastructure in this country. We simply have not, the government has not been able to regulate the sector. The government has not been able to parcel it out, license it out to players who could have come in and developed the sector, like they did in the case of cellular telephony. So because of the fact that we didn't have the infrastructure, we don't have broadband users. What that really shows is that we've got a huge amount of latent demand in that sector, which will explode the minute the infrastructure is available. Finally, what the government did last year was to actually parcel out the country into territories, license those out to four or five big companies. So now very large corporations are getting into rolling out broadband wireless access. And I believe that once that starts getting done in about a year's time, then you will see the catch-up India will have to do from 7 million broadband users. My sense is we'll leap to 100 in absolutely no time and then start growing a little bit more sensibly. But there's absolutely no reason why India should not have 200 to 300 million broadband users.
Of course, some people say that it's not just hard infrastructure problems, it's soft infrastructure problems, that India doesn't have the skilled workers, the project managing types coming through that other comparable countries do, so, which goes back to education and the sort of gross lack of education and teachers and so on. Is this something that worries you?
I would just join a bit of issue with that. I mean, you know, look at the way we've handled our cell phone growth. The engineers have been there, the people have been there, the soft infrastructure has been there. Look at the way India is managing its civil aviation growth, the fastest growing civil aviation market. So I think the soft skill base is there. The number of people who can deliver are there. Is it adequate? Clearly, no, because we're talking about 1.2 billion people in this country. We're talking about 70% of these people are under 35 years old. We're talking about 50% of the people under 25. India's got 600 million people under 25. Now, you need education infrastructure of the order that the world hasn't quite ever seen before. So if the question is it adequate? No. If the question is, has it been enough to power India's growth up to this point? Yes, it has. But is it going to be enough from here on to take India from, say, a $2 trillion economy, which is what we will be this year, to, you know, a $10, $12 trillion economy over the next 10 or 15 years? Gosh, they'll have to work very, very hard to do that.
My guest on Saturday Extra is Raghav Bal, the founder and managing director of Network 18 and a very respected entrepreneur within his country. Well, where's the money going to come from for all this? Like, I noticed you had a big drop, quite staggering drop in foreign and direct investment over the last few months in India. I don't know why that is. Maybe you can help us understand it. But, I mean, are there sort of big enough, deep enough pockets inside India to finance this?
Well, India is a very, very classically structured economy, like large democracies in the West, which have become very developed countries. So India is structured a lot like that. We have a very high domestic consumption base, unlike China. And therefore, we grow much more through organic consumption than through, say, pumped up investment or importing too much capital. Plus, we also have a very high savings rate within our population, about 35% of the GDP saved by people. So India does have a large amount of domestic capital, which needs to be tapped and brought into profitable investments. India also has a very large consumption base. Therefore, India grows much more organically than through investments. Therefore, India is always behind the curve in investments. India's always infrastructure is always minus one, unlike, say, China, where the infrastructure is, say, plus five. Mm-hmm. It's sort of five steps ahead of where the economy is. But in India, since we grow organically, our infrastructure is always lagging slightly behind. So our airports will always come up once the traffic has developed. Mm-hmm. Our roads will always, or bridges will always get built once the roads have once the traffic has developed. So India will be always one step behind. Of course, the good part of that is India uses capital much more efficiently than say, China does, because you're always trying to catch up rather than, you know, overbuild. But to the specific point about our ability to finance India's growth, clearly there is a lot of domestic capital which will come. Foreign capital, I know there has been a drop this year in foreign direct investment. And I suspect that's got a bit to do with some odd decisions that the government had taken about banning a few kinds of financial instruments which the foreigners like to come in, essentially convertible bonds. But I think that's a blip because, on the flip side, while foreign direct investment fell, see how much foreign institutional investment went up in India. So on the secondary market side, we had a flood of capital into India, highest for any emerging market in the world. So it's not as if the foreigners are not willing to put capital. I think they put in capital where capital was being welcomed with low transaction costs. So I think these are the kinds of issues which will ensure that India will always grow through a process of very tortured reform. But growth, I think, is certainly in there.
What about all the real estate speculation? Because I just think Mumbai is now second to Shanghai as the fastest growing real estate market in the world, or something or other. Is that a worry, do you think, for the emerging India?
Well, real estate in India is again to pick up a comparison with China, for instance. The Indian banks are extremely, extremely conservative about lending against real estate. Or against stocks and shares. So very, very conservative. The Indian Central Bank places huge prudential limits and guidelines on them. So I don't think the Indian real estate sector, the bubble, is being created by cheap availability of capital. On the other hand, capital is available in India for real estate purposes at above 15%. So you have to earn above 15% to get an economic rate of return. Unlike China, where A, it is available at very, very relatively lax prudential laws, plus the rate of interest is 3 or 4 or 5%. So the hurdle rate is much lower. So the point I'm trying to make is I think India's real estate demand is genuinely demand coming from people for new housing or from companies to get office space. Do also understand that in India, the supply is a constraint. We don't have that much supply coming through. Therefore, the prices tend to be high. So it's not a classical bubble situation. Mm-hmm. Having said that, the prices are high, but then you are subject to the laws of the market. And these prices will fall and some people will lose a lot of money in it. But the system is not put at risk because of that. Because this is not a bubble fueled by cheap availability of capital or indeed the kind of subprime excesses that we saw in the US. Nothing of that exists in India. So the prices are high and that's a pure factor of demand and supply.
Well, I have to raise corruption now. And I just want to read to you something that was a comment in the Hindustan Times business section by Dhirendra Kumar. There can be little doubt that there are many, many businesses in India that are built on a base that can't survive a harsh light shining brightly on them. While this is true of practically entire sectors like telecom, realty and airlines, it's probably true of many other industries as well. Now, you seem to have a different take on the future to him.
I certainly do. I think India's corruption is a big problem, but I don't think it's a problem which is there all across and in every sector. I think where the problem of corruption is endemic is in areas where natural resources are involved, where government policy hasn't evolved to the point that it is undertaking a fair allocation of those resources. Let's look at our mining laws, for instance. Now, that's an area where we've got massive corruption. Because our mining laws were made almost 100 years ago, and today there is such major discretion the government has in giving out those mines. And we all know that discretion leads to corruption. If you don't have transparent bidding and auctioning rules, there will be corruption. If a government officer or a government minister can just simply give away some natural resource, which is very, very precious, but he can give it with one signature of his pen, then the tendency to be corrupt and the ability to be corrupt is huge. So I think we are seeing massive corruption, but we are seeing massive corruption in some of these areas which have not been reformed. Areas which have been reformed, where transparent rules have come in, where competitive intensity is immense, those are seeing amazing amounts of efficiency. Those are seeing amazing amounts of regulatory transparency. Those are seeing amazing amounts of corporate transparency. In the Indian stock market must be amongst perhaps the most transparent in the world today. We haven't had a stock market scandal in India for the last 7 years. So there is a lot of corruption. I'm not saying that, but to say that it is generalized, to say that it is pervasive, to say that it touches every sector, I think it's all wrong. I think there, where the government has been lax about reforming, where we are still living under old laws which are not transparent, where there is an excessive amount of government discretion, I think there is corruption.
Raghav Bal, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Raghav Bal, the founder, controlling shareholder and managing director of Network 18. And I didn't ask him about because I knew he wasn't particularly interested in it, but there are 800 FM stations launching, like radio was starting to also make a comeback in 300 small towns across India. So that was also another amazing development in India's telecommunications industry. And that reference to corruption, by the way, we will also follow that up. There was an amazing debate around corruption, around the setting up of a sort of an ICAC or an ombudsman called the Lokpal, and it had fostered a big starvation. A man called Anna Hazari had set himself up to go on a big starvation campaign in order to get better accountability in the parliament. And that was a huge debate, which we'll bring you more of. And also, arranged marriage, a wonderful interview around about 8:45.